Welcome to AACP's podcast, Inside the Lab, where we discuss anything and everything that concerns today's laboratory professionals and pathologists. My name is Dr. Loti Mulder, and I'm one of your co-hosts. I'm the Director of Leadership and Empowerment at AACP.
And my name is Dr. Dan Milner, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer at AACP and also one of your co-hosts.
So today we're talking about vaccine safety, and we have some amazing guests with us today, and we are going to let them introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Dr. Hannah El-Sali. I am at Baylor College of Medicine, where I am an infectious diseases physician, seeing patients on the general and HIV services at Bentaub Hospital. I am also heavily invested in clinical vaccine development on the research side, including lately being involved in the phase 3 vaccine clinical trials that led to the EUA of some of the vaccines in our country.
Hi, my name is Lindsay Clark. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Laboratory Sciences at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Little Rock. I teach molecular diagnostics to our medical laboratory science students, as well as current topics in lab sciences. And so we have talked at length about COVID and the vaccine this year. I have received one dose of the vaccine, and I'm scheduled to get my second dose on Monday. So I am very excited about that.
My name is Anthony Reed. I am the CEO of Kidney Trails, also an AACP patient champion. I had actually got COVID back in December. I've also gotten both shots of the vaccine as well.
Great. So first of all, let's get a little housekeeping out of the way. CME and CMLE will be available for listening to this podcast in the AACP store. The American Society for Clinical Pathology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. AACP designates this enduring material for a maximum of one AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. So let's go ahead, and now that we've got that out of the way, and jump into some questions. So for Lindsay, first, let's talk about vaccines in general. Lindsay, can you tell us about the different types of vaccines, and is one type of vaccine safer than the others?
Yes. So there are four main categories of vaccines. One, the first category, live attenuated vaccines. And these are vaccines that were derived from disease-causing pathogens that have been weakened. These pathogens can still grow in the individual, but if they do, they cause no disease or very mild disease. Example of this type of vaccine would be the oral polio vaccine. The second type is an inactivated or what's called a killed antigen vaccine. These types of vaccines use microorganisms that have been killed using physical or chemical processes. So an example of this type of vaccine would be the inactivated poliovirus vaccine. The third type we have is subunit vaccines. These are also known as purified antigen vaccines. So these contain antigenic subunits of the pathogen. These are parts of the pathogen that elicit an immune response. And it's important to note, these are just contain part of the pathogen, where an inactivated vaccine would contain the whole cell. An example of a subunit vaccine would be the hepatitis B vaccine. The fourth type we have is toxoid vaccines, and these are inactivated toxins. These use a protein-based toxin that is rendered harmless, which is known as a toxoid. And these are used as an antigen to stimulate the immune response. An example of this type would be the tetanus toxoid vaccine. So now with COVID-19, we're starting to see new types of vaccines. Currently, the two COVID vaccines that have been given emergency use authorization by the FDA are messenger RNA vaccines. These are not live attenuated vaccines. And just like all vaccines, they have been thoroughly tested for safety. Speaking to whether one is more safe than the others, I wouldn't say that one is safer than the others, but all vaccines undergo extensive safety testing. There are no vaccines that are completely without risk, but in general, vaccines are very safe. So it is worth noting, however, that the live attenuated vaccines might carry a little bit more risk than the others. Specifically, they require certain storage conditions, and a lot of them require reconstitution. They come in a powdered form and they require someone to reconstitute those. So those are both areas that can lead to errors. They might not be stored properly. And if they're not reconstituted properly, those can be problems. Additionally, these attenuated pathogens in the vaccines can revert back to their pathogenic form and cause disease, although that is very rare. So these types of vaccines are not recommended in general for patients that are immunocompromised or immunosuppressed. But the reason that we still use live attenuated vaccines is because they do provide an excellent immune response. So they're really very good vaccines. But otherwise, I would say that all vaccines are very safe.
Great. Thank you. I was actually very interested. I didn't personally know that there were so many different types of vaccines. My follow-up question is for Hanna. Can you tell a little bit more about how the mRNA vaccines work and what were some of the common reactions observed after people received one?
Yes. So the messenger RNA vaccines contain the code that is needed to produce the protein of interest. In the case of the COVID-19, the protein of interest here is what we call the spike protein. It is on the exterior surface of the virus, and our immune system directs the antibodies and the cell-mediated immunity heavily to this particular protein, and it is thought to result in the immunity that is seen. So the messenger RNA will code for this protein. It gets injected in the body. Once it's injected, our cells will produce the spike protein, and the messenger RNA itself in the process gets degraded. Once our immune cells see the spike protein, they will start triggering the immune response. The lymph nodes are involved in the process. And this immune response is what is thought to confer protection once we are exposed to the virus down the line. The reactions that were observed in both the Pfizer and the Moderna trial can be divided into two categories. The local reactions, so that's the redness, the swelling, the pain at the injection site, maybe some lymph node tenderness on the side of the injection. And these reactions usually occur within the first few days of the vaccination, and they resolve, you know, over the ensuing couple of days. The other type of reactions are more systemic, meaning some low-grade fever, fatigue, headache, nausea. These symptoms have also occurred in the first few days after the vaccination, and they resolve over a couple of days. Both the systemic and the local reactions are responsive to medications that are over the counter, like ibuprofen, paracetamol. So a lot of our volunteers on the studies and after the EUA rollout have used these medications to ease the symptoms with success. What is a bit peculiar with these vaccines has been that we observed more of a reaction with the second dose than the first dose. So we always prepare our volunteers and our colleagues as they are taking the vaccines during the EUA that you might get a little more pronounced reaction with your second dose than your first dose. But it's variable. And the other particular sort of information or finding we had with the studies is that older individuals seem to have had an easier time with the vaccine than younger individuals. You know, they had some reactions, but for the most part, older individuals had milder reaction than younger ones.
And do we know why that is? Because for the most part, what we've heard is that people who are younger are less affected by the actual COVID disease, so that their reaction to the vaccine is more significant. Do we have any speculation on that?
It's not clear why that is, why we're seeing a stronger reactogenicity in younger individuals. The way the virus potentially activates the immune system has to do with it, but pinpointing the etiology has not been done. We can't really pinpoint and say your cells of category X are the ones that are causing this differential between the age groups.
So for Lindsay and Hannah, you know, you guys can pass this one back and forth, but can you talk a little bit about vaccine testing and approval process and how safety is ensured? Because I think one of the messages we want to get across that Lindsay reiterated is that vaccines are safe, but can you talk about that and also address the fact that this vaccine was developed so quickly and released so quickly? Were there any safety measures that had to be compromised, or should we think of it as being just as safe as any other vaccine because it was rolled out faster? So I'll let both of you tackle that one.
So as far as vaccines go, they are considered pharmaceutical products and they undergo extensive safety testing and they're also tested for efficacy. All of this starts in a research laboratory and then moves into testing the product in animal models. It has to pass those first two before it can then move on into the clinical trial phases. Every vaccine goes through three phases of clinical trials in human subjects before it can be licensed. It starts in phase one, and those are, it tests the vaccine in a smaller population. Phase two has a larger sample size, and phase three uses yet a larger sample size. So by the time the vaccine gets to the phase three trials, researchers are looking at the efficacy of the vaccine in preventing disease and looking at safety in a larger, more diverse population over a longer period of time. Once all of that data is collected, it is submitted to the FDA for approval. After it is approved or licensed is generally when pharmaceutical companies will begin manufacturing and distributing the vaccine.
I have a follow-up question on that. So currently there are three FDA-approved vaccines in the U.S., the Johnson & Johnson, the Moderna, and the Pfizer one. Do we know that all three trials were completed by all three companies?
I do know that Pfizer and Moderna went through all three clinical phase trials. Johnson & Johnson was just very recently approved, so...
None of these vaccines are actually approved. They are all still considered investigational under and received emergency authorization. And that's two. The third is actually undergoing deliberations right now on the other, you know, this is where I was on the other screen watching before I logged in to this meeting. I didn't know there was going to be a conflict, but anyway. So two vaccines have received emergency use authorization, and that's the Moderna and the Pfizer BioNTech. They are very similar in terms of construct, and their data from the phase three were also sort of leaning towards similar findings. The Johnson & Johnson Janssen product, of course, had to undergo phase three testing, and they did submit their request for an emergency use authorization, which is currently being deliberated by the FDA.
So can you talk a little bit about the difference between emergency authorization and approval?
Emergency use authorization is sort of a measure that is taken where there's a public health emergency. And we are in a situation where there's a deadly pandemic with no effective measure that was in place to stop it. Research began at many levels, whether it's therapeutic or preventive in terms of vaccines. And when data become available that where the risk benefit evaluation is in favor of administering a product, then the FDA will issue an emergency use authorization for a particular pharmaceutical, and they will continue to gather data. Given the sort of the critical value of a vaccine from a public health standpoint to stem the epidemic, the FDA did issue guidance back in June to the industry as to what is considered minimum criteria to obtain the emergency use authorization. And all the manufacturers had to follow these guidelines in order to obtain the emergency use authorization.
So I think to round that out, you know, we could summarize it by saying, there are two vaccines currently available, both of which are mRNA, which is a new form of vaccine. And then there's one that's being deliberated that may soon be available, which is a more traditional vaccine type. But if you
it's
get-
It's not traditional actually either.
Unique too. What's special about the Johnson & Johnson Janssen product relative to the types of vaccines that we heard about?
The Janssen vaccine is a vector-based vaccine. So individuals will receive a virus that is adenovirus 26 that is incapable of replicating in the human body, but will deliver the code that will produce the spike protein. And once the immune system sees the spike protein, it will trigger an immune response and the cascade goes from there. So in the US, that is also a novel way of producing or administering vaccine.
Yeah. Thank you for that explanation, Hannah. So I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there are some other experimental vaccines that use that same process, maybe even one for HIV, but this is the first time it will actually be used. Okay. So getting back to our question then about the safety and the process that was used for these, what are the unknowns that are related to these vaccines for now? What are the things that we don't know about them that we will have to look for as we vaccinate more and more people that will be informative?
There are a few things that we need to pay attention to as these vaccines are being rolled out. For instance, there was a concern about side effects. The issue of anaphylaxis came early on as a problem. Now the CDC has followed millions of individuals who received the vaccine. And we do know that, for example, for the Moderna, it's in the range of 2.5 per million in terms of anaphylaxis. And in the case of Pfizer, it's 4.7 per million. So all in all, a low rate. The Bell's palsy, there was an imbalance, for example, in the cases. There were slightly more in the vaccine compared to the placebo. The CDC also, this morning, they had a presentation on the data accrued so far. And now we know that after millions of individuals received the vaccine, if there was no difference in Bell's palsy occurrence compared to the baseline. So these additional safety data are important to gather. The other important factor is that these vaccines were rolled into long-term care facilities, which is slightly different than the population we tested the vaccine on. We tested it in, we did have quite a representation of older individuals, but not, for example, as debilitated as being in a nursing home. And we know that these vaccines were given in nursing homes. So seeing how these vaccines fared in these patients in terms of decreasing the intensity of the epidemic in this population and many others, for example, individuals with cancer on chemotherapy or people with advanced immunosuppression for any reason, they are getting the vaccine now, and collecting efficacy data post EUA is going to be important. And as a corollary to that, we need to remember that the EUA was obtained for Pfizer and Moderna, but the clinical trials did not stop. We are still following the volunteers in both trials, and we are still following them for any occurrence of COVID-like symptoms so we can swab them, so we can obtain efficacy data in the long term in order to have an idea of the waning of the immunity over time. And last but not least, we are hearing everywhere about variants, whether these vaccines will protect against variants and to what degree they will protect against variants are two open questions. And the fact that the individuals on the EUA or on the clinical trials are being followed, it's going to give us an idea of the degree of cross-reactivity of these vaccines against these new variants. I can think of more questions, but at least these are the eminent ones.
Thank you. Thanks.
Quick question. They're following these participants, but are those participants considered part of the phase four trial? Or are they still following the phase three participants?
In both trials, the Pfizer and the Moderna, the volunteers were unblinded and they received the product and are receiving. And we're in the process of giving them the product. So soon enough, no one will be on placebo. Whether it's considered phase three or phase four now, phase four is technically post-marketing. So the vaccine is not marketed. It's still under EUA at best. So it's a designation. And you can argue it's closer to a phase four than a phase three now, but also they are not the general population. So
in the news, there's been a lot of talk about high-risk patients and comorbidities. Anthony, I know that a few years back, you were diagnosed with end-stage renal disease, and then you received a kidney transplant. I believe it was in 2017, but please correct me if I'm wrong. And then you shared that you then contracted COVID a few months back. So what was your biggest concern about getting vaccinated, and then what solidified your decision to get vaccinated in the end?
Well, the first thing is, what would it do to the transplanted organ? I didn't want to have an adverse effect to the transplanted organ and have to be in the same position I was a few years ago. So that was my first concern. So when everything started going down, I definitely was talking through to my transplant clinic and to some other different individuals to try to gather enough information so I could make a good enough decision, a solidified decision to own the vaccine. And once I got that, I was pretty confident that I was going to get it at a certain time. And when I ended up getting COVID, I had started talking to my transplant team even more. They were checking on me every few days. And one of the things I asked them, I said, look, is it possible for me to still get the vaccine? I'm going to have to wait the 3 months. Is it even safe for me to get? And they just found out the American Association of Transplant Physicians had given their approval. And that pretty much solidified my decision, said, yes, you need to get the vaccine. And then they said, get it as quickly as you can. So that gave me my concrete decision that that was going to happen. So.
And Anthony, were you, as a transplant patient with, you know, as Loti said, comorbidities, was that something where you were offered the vaccine very quickly in your community? Did you have to special request to be able to get the vaccine? How did that work in your case?
Well, one of the things is that I'm actually considered a frontline worker, because one of the other things I do is I work in a dialysis clinic, and we are patient face-to-face contact on a daily basis. And so that's how come I was able to get it. Plus, being transplanted, it kind of threw me up to the top of the list. And I'd actually scheduled to get mine in a certain time, and then I got the COVID. So I had to wait a little bit longer till I got over the COVID than to get the vaccine.
So for a patient or an individual who's had a transplant or has other comorbidities where they are not a frontline worker, they are still a priority to get the vaccine and just in the community. Is that correct?
I am starting to see that more are getting them. I know that dialysis patients are getting them now. I have seen where transplant patients are getting them now. I believe there's some different things that have come down. They've had to really talk to different individuals to get things to get us up on the list, because at first we weren't a higher priority, at least the dialysis. Transplant was kind of up there because we are immune compromised, but people are starting to get them that have either dialysis or a transplant. And that's, I was very grateful to see that, very glad and very excited to see that.
And that really brings up something that Hannah touched on that you are representing, which is the immunosuppressed patient and concerns or safety concerns around them. I know personally, when I first read about these vaccines, and I don't know if Hannah shared my thought on this at the time, when I first read about these vaccines that had mRNA in them, I thought to myself biologically, well, what if somebody has HIV and they're not being treated and they've got reverse transcriptase floating around, is that a problem? And then I convinced myself it probably isn't. But I think it would be good to hear from you, maybe Lindsay, can you speak to what the risks are for immunosuppressed patients? Are there anything in particular? Are there any groups that are specifically have a type of immunosuppression that have been restricted from getting the vaccine?
Yeah, I'd love to speak about that. So for when I talk about immunosuppressed individuals, I'm talking about usually those that are on medications that are suppressing their immune system to treat some sort of disorder. So personally, I take an injectable biologic to treat a rare autoimmune disease that I have. I had these same questions. I was really concerned, is this going to be safe for me? I have no immune system because I have killed it to save myself, essentially. And so I started looking initially before the vaccines came out to see what kind of information was out there about COVID and immunosuppressed individuals. And the data that's out there ranges from you're going to be just fine, no extra precautions are needed, to if you get COVID, it's likely going to be very serious. And so we have this very broad range. And what that tells me is that we really don't know right now at this point what effect overall it's going to have. And it very well may be that it's a very sort of individual effect, depending on the condition the person has, what medications they're on, things like that. So we do know, though, just from looking at past data, that we have vaccines that are safe for immunosuppressed and immunocompromised patients. And so it is recommended to not get a live attenuated vaccine for those on immunosuppressant medications or immunocompromised patients. But the COVID vaccines that are currently authorized are not live attenuated vaccines. And so when I started doing some research and reading, I spoke with my rheumatologist, my primary care doctor, and decided that it was best to get the vaccine. They both had recommended that and had done their own research into it. We talked about it. And for me personally, it was the best choice. It is at this time, it is recommended for those on immunosuppressant medications to get the vaccine unless they have some sort of contraindication. So if they're allergic to the vaccine ingredients or something along those lines.
And then for either Lindsay or Anthony, did you experience any side effects that were more significant from the vaccine because of your health histories, or were they pretty much in line with everybody else?
Anthony, go ahead.
I experienced the first shot. I experienced a little bit of fever, a little bit of body aches, just really tired. But after the day after when I woke up, I felt better than I had felt in a long time, which was quite amazing to me. I can tell you that the effects that I felt getting the vaccine was nowhere close to actually having the disease itself, having experienced both of them. So I was quite pleased with that. The second shot, I had a little tiredness, a little sore. That was it. So for me, my experience, I was very grateful for it.
That's great, because that's actually, there's some anecdotal evidence that's coming out that especially for those COVID long haulers that they end up feeling better after vaccine. So it sounds like you had some similar experiences. That's great. And Lindsay?
Yes.
What about you?
For me, I've had the first dose of the vaccine and I had virtually no side effects. My arm was a little bit sore and that was it. So I would say I didn't really experience any of the major side effects. So I get my next dose on Monday. So I'm hoping it will be the same for Monday. But I agree with Anthony. What happened when I woke up the next morning, I felt great, which doesn't happen all the time when you have an autoimmune disorder. So I was like, wow, maybe I'll get more of these.
So Hannah, we have Anthony as an N of one who had COVID, but then chose to get vaccinated. But what is the general recommendation for people who've had COVID? I mean, but it's clearly safe, but what is the official recommendation for people who've had COVID and whether or not they should get vaccinated?
So individuals who had COVID are also recommended to have the vaccine. They are probably not under as much urgency as everyone else in terms of time. We do know from large studies in the UK, in Austria, I think one is published recently, that the first 6 months after infection, reinfections are rare. So they have time. So if there's, let's say, shortage of doses, I would prioritize individuals who didn't have COVID, but not forget about those who had COVID. So they can be sort of maybe second in line kind of thing. So they are recommended to overall to have the vaccine. And with the vaccine production and distribution being ramped up in the last, I would say, 2-3 weeks in our country, there's more opportunity to vaccinate everyone, especially if they fall in a high-risk category.
You know, we talked a lot about safety in terms of the vaccine itself. In terms of safety for the entire population, including those who have not yet received the vaccine, what are some recommendations that for those people who have had it? So should they still wear masks? Should they quarantine for a few days after getting the vaccine? I know it's not a live vaccine, but can you just talk a little bit more about those precautions that those who are vaccinated should still follow?
Yes. So people who are vaccinated are at lower risk of having COVID disease. The studies have shown that, and they are comparable. And actually, now we know from even post-marketing, post-EUA data, at least from one large healthcare system, that it is still the case. But other people in the community remain susceptible. People around us are not vaccinated. The vaccine protects us from disease, but we do not know whether we can get infected yet not show the disease. And that happens often in respiratory viruses and in the older varieties of corona. That does happen. So in order to be confident in dropping the mask, we need sort of a faith or indication, is the right word, that herd immunity has built, meaning large numbers of individuals have gotten the vaccine or the infection, but hopefully the vaccine, to the point where if they are exposed, they are not at risk of complications of getting the disease. Now, epidemiologists and modeling experts differ as to where the herd immunity is going to hit. Is it 50? Is it 60? Is it 80? Given how transmissible and this virus is, I see the number keep going up. A lot of it is guessing and projection, but that's all we have. So we have to go with that. It's being estimated that close to 80% of people need to have seen either the virus or the vaccine for people to feel confident in dropping their masks everywhere they go. Having said that, the reality is that each one of us has their bubble. If people in our bubble, especially the older people in our bubble and the vulnerable people in our bubble, are vaccinated or have had the disease, you can potentially drop your mask around them and feel confident that way and that you're not harming others. But otherwise, until we know that more people have received these highly effective vaccines, we should be maintaining in general social distancing and masking.
And then, Anthony, did you have any thoughts on that? I know, I mean, you work in a dialysis center, and then you also, I know you have three very young children. What, do you want to comment on any of that as well?
I mean, I was kind of used to wearing a mask at the time when it all hit, because especially during like flu season, because of the immune compromised. For right now, you know, of course, I mask up when I'm out. Definitely try to keep my children safe, try to keep my family safe and the others safe. So at this point in time, I think it's probably a good idea to continue to keep wearing a mask until otherwise noted. Keeps us all, I guess you could say it this way, it would keep me out of the hospital, would be a good way that I would see it coming from the patient side of things. Coming from the professional side, it would keep others out of the hospital. So others out of even more adverse situations than that. So at this point in time, yes, until we get to a point that we can.
We would like to talk about another issue, which is, you know, everyone on this podcast is obviously either gotten the vaccine or hoping to get the vaccine soon. I know that's me. I live in an area with a lot of old people, so I'm way down the list to get the vaccine. But there are those that are hesitant to get the vaccine or still have some reservations. And so I'd like to hear from everyone about, you know, people you've met or worked with or even groups that you're aware of that are hesitant and what that hesitancy is and why it's important to remember when speaking to people, like, what should we say to them who might be hesitant? What can we do to encourage them to get the vaccine? And we can start with you maybe, Lindsay.
Sure. Well, for one, initially, when the trials were first starting, there's actually a trial in my area, and somebody asked me if I was going to sign up to participate in the trial. And I was like, no, of course not. And because I had some hesitancy about it at that point as well. And I think this hesitancy, a lot of it is coming from, we are hit with so much different information in so many different ways. It's on the news, it's on our social media, it's coming through the internet. It's coming at us a million miles an hour from everywhere. And it's a lot of it is conflicting information. There's a lot of incorrect information out there that sounds plausible. And so where people are hearing this that don't have a medical or scientific background, to them, it sounds, you know, that definitely could be the case that this isn't safe or what have you. So for me, I did a lot of talking to my physicians, talking to my colleagues, did a lot of reading from reputable sources, and really found that actually this vaccine didn't really skip any of those safety measures. There were other ways that it was sort of developed so quickly, and eventually I found that actually this is a very safe vaccine. Much like Anthony mentioned, I am afraid of being in the hospital. I'm afraid of what will happen to me if I get COVID, and it is serious. And so for me to be able to prevent that in any way, that's what I'm going to do. As far as talking to people who are hesitant, I think it's really important to listen to those individuals to see, why are you hesitant? Have you been reading inaccurate information? Is there some reason that you believe this inaccurate information? And then you can try to guide them to more accurate, more scientifically sound information. But I think it's just listening and figuring out, are they just worried? Are they worried about every vaccine they get? Is it just, and not necessarily that it's a COVID vaccine that was developed so quickly, but just it's a vaccine in general, and they are a little fearful of those anyways. So just really listening and addressing their specific hesitancy, I think, is the most important.
Anthony?
So I'm actually going to, what Lindsay said, I agree. I look at it as a few different reasons why people don't get the vaccine. It kind of is interesting because it's some things I have found the same reason some people wouldn't want to get a transplant. The first reason I would say is people don't have enough of the right information. And this is very key. A lot of people, like Lindsay said, they get their information from other sources that may not be as reliable. It sounds great. It sounds like it should work, but don't really do the research and just give out whatever. So I'd say the first reason would definitely be not to have enough of the right information. The second, kind of hand in hand with that, is they have too much of the wrong information. There has to be a happy balance between all these things. And I have found out that if people have too much of the wrong information, that can be detrimental to their decision, whether it would be with the vaccine. And I have experienced that, as well as the people don't have, they have too much of that wrong information. Well, what about this? What about that? And you're like, wait a minute, let's back up just a little bit. Let's go this step by step. And so those are two that I've seen. And then you've got I think it's a very small percentage of people that are just made up their mind they're not going to get it no matter what. And that's their decision. And it could be from, you know, they found out the information and realized that they could have adverse reactions to the vaccine. It could be a number of different things. I think that will eventually be a small percentage. I think the main reason why people may be hesitant is those first two. And I would say definitely be knowledgeable, be ready with your information, have the facts ready at a moment's notice, and just share it with them. Just listen to them, hear their concerns, and share that information that you have. And you may see a little difference in their response, you know, later on, whether they're going to get the vaccine or not. And sometimes it's going to take time for people to think about what you've said and to really grasp it and say, okay, they may be right. And also share them, say, look, I found it on, you know, this is where it's coming from. It's coming from this reputable source. It's coming from this university. It's coming from this research team. And a lot of times when they do that, it really helps them. The other thing that I found out is I've had people say, well, did you get the vaccine? Well, yes. Well, what was your experience? So share your experience as well. That helps them say, oh, okay, well, if he made it through, if she made it through, then, well, I should be okay. So I think that's another way to approach the situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point, Anthony. What we would call in quotes survivor stories, close quotes, right, of the vaccine. I think that messaging is really important. That's why we so greatly appreciate you and all of our patient champions who always advocate for the lab, but can be a really important voice in this time of crisis. Hannah, your thoughts on hesitancy?
Gosh, hesitancy is such a big problem that has sort of plagued our public health situation even before COVID hit. Education is one tool against it, reminding people that of all the medical advances that we've had over the last 100 years, probably vaccines ranks supreme along with a few others in terms of improving our health quality of life, our longevity, childhood mortality. So sometimes it takes reminders and education, because no one who's young and even now into middle age has seen the ravages of polio, or the, unless, you know, they were in a particular location elsewhere. So reminding individuals of the importance of vaccines in terms of public health and individual health is important. And one tactic I always employ, and it works on many, not all, individuals, is telling them that I took the vaccine. Many of my patients in the HIV clinic belong to disadvantaged minorities, and hesitancy in these groups can be large sometimes. And I try to convince them one way or the other until I tell them, listen, I and my kids took it. Would I give you something that I would not take myself? And that seems to sway a proportion. I'm not going to say all, but it does sway a proportion. So making them sort of understand that we're in it together. It's not just that I'm giving you something that I would not take. It helps sometimes. There are many more tactics and certain tools that need to be employed at other levels, but I don't know that we have the time or space to discuss those right now.
That's a really valid point. And as I mentioned earlier about survivor stories, you know, one of the reasons we've been so successful with HIV treatment, for example, in Africa, is because people are surviving HIV and talking about that and, you know, moving on. And I think the more people hear from people that they have a disease and they're doing fine with it based on the treatment, the more accepted that treatment becomes. And having a vaccination is no different. And at this point, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, we're at about 1 in 10 people have had COVID, if I'm not correct. It's 25 million people at a 300 million. I believe that works out to maybe 1 in 20, something like that. And about 1 in 1,000 have died. So this is a high incidence, high visibility disease. And so we don't want that to be the main driver. But certainly at some point, even if you're hesitant, you have to realize that this is clearly a real thing. And if the vaccine can protect you from it, you know, it would be worth it to try to consider that if you have access to it, right? I mean, I think that's the other challenge that we've found, is that I would love to get the vaccine, but I currently can't where I am. But for people who can get it, that they should if they can. So I think we're getting close to the hour. So I'm going to go ahead and thank all of you so much for participating. This has been a really enlightening and fascinating discussion. I'm sure our audience of the podcast has enjoyed it. And I know that I know that Loti and I both learned a lot from this as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, thank you all for sharing your stories and sharing your knowledge about the vaccines with the two of us and with all of our listeners as well. I would like to remind our listeners that you can subscribe through your favorite podcast aggregator so you don't miss any of our future episodes.
And finally, don't forget that if you want to receive CME or CLE credit for listening to our podcast, go to Inside the Lab. Go to the ASCP store at www.ascp.org.